Two people singled out for praise. Two people singled out for praise. This is like the Oscars, isn't it? This is the awards ceremony in the Philippian letter. Up until now, nobody really has been focused on for particular mention. It's been talking in generalities, in wide terms about the activity of the church and the praise for the congregation. And then as we go through the first chapter, he's talking about his own situation and the influence that he's able to have in his predicament, his attitude to his sufferings, and so on. And then in the second chapter, he looks to the future and he sees the challenges that the Philippians are likely to face, and he wants to prepare them, he wants to ready them, he wants to encourage them that when their moment of crisis comes, when the darkness falls, that they will shine like stars. They're going to be outstanding Christians. That's his desire. They should be outstanding Christians. But then he, in verse 19, shifts the kind of structure of what he's saying, and he zeroes in and he zooms in on two people. You know what it's like at the awards ceremony? Suddenly the spotlight is going around like this, and it just goes zoom, and it focuses on somebody out there in the audience, and it mentions them by name, and it calls them up to the front, and they come up the red carpet, and they're presented before everybody, and their achievements are enumerated, what they've done, how they've lived, why they're here today, why we should be looking at these people. What is it about these people that sets them apart? And it's not just so that they get so big-headed that although they could get in the door, they can't get out again. That's not the function and the purpose of this. It's to set the benchmark. It's to say what counts. It's to say what we should be aiming at. What are the qualities that we should hope to see in and see developed in us? To inspire. That's the ultimate aim, isn't it? It's to stir people up. If he's saying that the hope is that in difficult times, these Christians in Philippi, ordinary Christians in Philippi, are going to shine like stars, he says, here's two stars I want you to look at. Look what they're like. See how they live. Emulate these examples. And I don't think I'm forcing that on the text in verse 29. When he's talking about Epaphroditus there, honor such men. Take people like this and focus your attention upon them. Give them the credit that is their due. Consider people like this. We give out medals in our society, don't we? For all sorts of things. You can get a medal for civic activities. You can get a medal for distinguished service. I think I've got a... It's not exactly a medal. I don't know where I put it. I have got here. We went paintballing yesterday. 30 degrees of heat it was. Unbelievable. But, oh yeah, I got a Top Gun award. I was so pleased. I was a kid with a new toy. It was a good day yesterday, wasn't it? We had a good time. But we went up against all sorts of people, and eventually I got pulled up in front of everybody. So did Tally, by the way. Serious sniper fire from Tally. I got pulled up for outstanding courage and leadership in battle. So I was really thrilled with that. So on a domestic level in schools, we give out awards. This whole process of setting people apart, putting people up in front of other people, is something very common. It's an important function of how society works, isn't it? It's there. And there's something called a campaign medal. You can get a campaign medal. That just means that in the battle for North Africa, you were there, you were in the uniform, you were part of the team, and you get a little badge. But there's also what you might call a distinguished service award. And the highest of those in the military field is, of course, the Victoria Cross. And distinguished service is when somebody doesn't just turn up. The way they conduct themselves, the things that they do, you could never ask a person to do this within the line of their duty. You could never expect a person to do this. You could never sit down and say, well, this is the standard I want you to. They go over and above and beyond what you could ask or expect or think. Listen to the description that's given for those who are awarded the Victoria Cross. This is an award for conspicuous bravery, for daring, preeminent acts of valor, for preeminent acts of self-sacrifice, extreme devotion to duty in the presence of the enemy. And this award has been around for 150 years or thereabouts, I don't know how many people have we put in battle dress over that period. A lot of people. A lot of people. Two world wars. A lot of people. Only less than 1,500 people have been awarded this Distinguished Service Cross, the Victoria Cross. Outstanding conduct. Outstanding conduct. And amazingly, you can actually get something called the Victoria Cross with bar. Only 3 people have ever won the Victoria Service with bar. And that effectively means you've won it twice. Twice. And of those 3 people, I wonder if you could mention all their names. Our most decorated soldiers. Could you mention any of their names? One of them, I can tell you, is a New Zealander. He said with a New Zealand twang. The other 2 were Brits. The one who is considered our most decorated soldier. And the reason he's considered the most decorated is because his tomb, you know, the war memorials trust thing that puts all these white stones around the place. Both his Victoria Crosses are actually inscribed on the front of his tombstone because he died in the act which won him the 2nd Victoria Cross. So it was awarded posthumously. And there are more war memorials with this man's name inscribed on it than any other person in the whole of British military history, which is amazing. And none of us, I suspect, know his name. And amazingly, and this moves me, this man didn't hurt a fly. As far as we know, he didn't kill a single soldier. Does anybody know his name? Our most decorated, celebrated soldier. It was called Noel Chavis. And we've forgotten. How Noel Chavis, son of a vicar, growing up in a poor part of Liverpool, his father went on to become the Bishop of Liverpool, actually, got a first-class honours degree from Oxford University and studied to be a surgeon. And when World War broke out, he joined the Army Medical Corps. And their duties were essentially to wait in the camps behind the lines, and when the wounded were brought back, to perform the relentless task of all the operations that were necessary to try and rescue their lives. But Noel Chavis went beyond the call of duty. He climbed over the trenches with the soldiers, out into the line of fire, out onto no man's land, out amongst the barbed wire and the bullets and the bombs and the craters and the blood and the groaning. He went within 25 yards of the enemy lines, seeking who he might save, looking for the wounded, crawling in the bunkers, giving Christian burials to those who had fallen. He carried on his own back 20 men from the front line and brought them back to the dressing tents behind, under heavy fire, at night, in the dark. And for this he was awarded, and rightly, the Victoria Cross. And if I mention the name of the 2nd battle that he was involved with, and if I mention the name Passchendaele, you'd understand what I'm talking about. He did it again at Passchendaele. But this time, in the course of his duties, he sustained injuries that cost him his life subsequent to the battle. Our most decorated soldier, and we've forgotten his name. How many of you constantly give yourself time and opportunity, not constantly, how many of you give time and opportunity to consider the acts of service of Epaphroditus, that great gospel hero? How many of you have inscribed his name on your memories, his acts, his works, his deeds? How many of you have given him honor that is due to his name? Because the double Victoria Cross is famous amongst ourselves. But God had his name inscribed in this book that should be read by Christians here, everywhere, all through time. This man is to be honored in the church by God's people down through the ages, all round the world. Now that is a medal of honor. That is special mention in dispatches. This is a remarkable man that we're reading about here in the Bible, along with Timothy, these 2 men. And I'm not stretching the whole analogy with the military too far, I don't think. Because in verse 25, as Paul talks about Epaphroditus, he says, my brother, my fellow worker, my fellow soldier. He likens the Christian acts of service to the discipline, courage, fortitude, bravery, technical abilities that you expect in the finest soldier you will find. And he singles him out for mention. Epaphroditus. In 2 Timothy, the letter that Paul eventually wrote to Timothy later on, he described him there as a good soldier. As a good soldier. So both these men have been awarded the highest praise for their analogous to their military exploits in the service of the gospel of Jesus Christ. So let's look at these qualities that these men exhibit that should bring us to give ourselves to their attention. Look at it there in Timothy verse 19, about Timothy verse 19. What do we find there? Not haughtiness, servant-heartedness. That's what sets him apart. Who is the person? He's not doing it for the glory. He's not doing it for the medals. He's not doing it for the praise. He was doing it for you. That's what he's saying. You know, people can put on a good show of care and interest in others, but really what's happening is they're drawing attention to themselves, and it's their own careerism and whatever it is it might be, their own hypocrisy. But Paul, as he studied Timothy, he says, this man, when he does what he's doing, he is genuinely, he has your welfare at the top of his list. That is who he's like. That is what he's like, this man. He just wants to serve you. He just wants to do you good. That's a remarkable character trait, isn't it? And it makes me think about the Lord Jesus' teaching when they were saying, who's going to be, you know, the greatest in the kingdom? Do you remember all that? The one who serves, the greatest servant amongst you, that'll be the greatest one. The one who helps you the most, the one who does the most for you, not out of self-interest to draw attention to themselves, because it's coming right from their heart. It's a work of God. That is the greatest amongst you. And then he brought that little child, didn't he? It's quite interesting how embedded these ideas are into our culture. What do we call our first ranking politician? We call them the prime minister. Minister means servant, doesn't it? Prime means first. You're the first servant of the nation, of crown, people alike. This man, this person, is the greatest servant amongst you, the one who most wholeheartedly seeks your welfare and your highest good. That's what we're saying, isn't it, when we call somebody and elect somebody to be our prime minister. And in verse 20, I think that's what Paul is saying about Timothy. He says, I have nobody like him. Nobody. That's high praise, isn't it? He knew a lot of people. He knew a lot of Christians. I haven't got anybody like this man. In terms of acts of service, genuine servant-heartedness, Timothy is the prime minister. And when he turns to Epaphroditus in verse 25, we see that heroism, this preparedness to take risks, even at the expense of his own personal safety for the sake of others. It's not gung-ho. It's not for the glory. It's not for the thrills. It's not to draw attention to himself. It's at a certain point, he looks at his own life. He looks at the cost. He looks at the harm that he could sustain. He looks at the pain that he may endure. And then he calculates it out about the pain and the disquiet that could affect others if he doesn't do what he's been called to do. And he puts those two things on the accounts, on the debit and the credit side, and he comes up with a conclusion, said, I must do, because my suffering, my discomfort, is less significant, ultimately, in the great plan of God, than the sufferings that will be consequent if I don't do what I'm called to do. And he puts his own personal safety at risk, not in a rash way, but in a considered. He's counted the cost. He counts the cost. So here's that first quality. Selfless service to the gospel and God's people. Concern. Heartfelt concern for God, for his gospel, and for his people. Right? Okay? We agree? It's warm, isn't it? Now the second one, the second quality. You see, both these men have got a lot in common. They're both, they've obviously got to share the same faith and so on and so forth. But I think the second thing I really want to pull out from this is they are willing, these men are willing to go. They've got that concern, but they're also prepared to turn that concern into real, credible action. They are ready to go. We see that in verse 19, that Timothy, and this isn't for the first time, Paul has a message that he wants carrying. He wants a job. He has a job that he can see he's doing. And this man is ready to do it. He's on his toes. He's waiting for orders. He's in a state of readiness. He is ready. This man is ready to go. And Epaphroditus is exactly the same. He's just come back off one mission. He's just arrived. But he's ready. If you send me again, I'll go. These men are ready to go, ready to deploy, as they say in the army. There's a verse that this conjured up in my mind. I was thinking about this. Isaiah chapter 6. I don't think anybody's going to be surprised if I quoted it. Isaiah has this vision, and he has this sense of the glorious presence of God. He hears the angels and the creatures crying, "Holy, holy, holy." We love singing, don't we? Holy, holy, holy. But what comes afterwards? Lord God Almighty. Yes, very good. That's not what I was thinking. Bless you, though. Whom shall I send? Who will go for us? The challenge, the question. It's good to worship. But who will go? Who will go? That's the question that's being put, isn't it, in that passage. And what does he reply? Sovereign Lord, send me. Not send him. Here I am. Here I am. And these men have something of this about their character, don't they? They are willing. Are you willing? Are you willing to go? Do you have that concern in your heart? In a sufficient measure that it moves your will, your natural inclinations to habit and comfort, but it overwhelms these things and you're prepared to make a commitment and go. That's what we see is happening in these people's lives. They become very flexible. I love when you see clay being making a pot. It's really sloppy, messy stuff. It's really flexible, isn't it? And the guy can just push it with his thumbs and he can create a shape out of it as he pleases. As he pleases. Are you willing to go? Because I know, and you know, that a volunteer is worth 100 conscripts. You can force people to do things to a degree. You get so much results. But somebody whose heart's been changed and they're ready, you know, they're going to do great things. So if that heart of selfless service is there, you know as a consequence of that, that willingness to go is going to be there too. That's going to be one of the things you're going to see exhibited there. But I want you to just think about the geography of this. Now, you'll be forgiven for not knowing where Philippi is, because I don't expect all of you to know where Macedonia is, and know basically it's over towards Istanbul, if that gives you any orientation whatsoever. But I'm not going to tell you where Rome is, because if you don't know where that is at this point in your life, I think we're going to write off your geography. But the distance is 500 miles. So when they're ready to go, they're ready to undertake journeys of over 500 miles. No easy jet, on foot, on the sea, in the mountains, in the heat, in the cold, on their own, in the cities, amongst strangers. 500 miles. If you started walking now on the flat for 500 miles, I think it'd take you about 2 weeks. 8 hours a day, something like that. 3 miles an hour if you take it easy. And I'm not surprised Epaphroditus nearly died. Listen to this. Listen to what Paul said about what it was like traveling in the first century. He's talking to the Corinthian church. 3 times I was shipwrecked. They were rubbish boats, right? Have you ever anybody been on a Greek bus? It's very similar. 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I was left adrift out at sea. You still get white, great whites in the Mediterranean. I didn't realize that. But on frequent journeys, in danger from rivers, in danger from robbers, in danger from my own people, in danger from the Gentiles, in danger in the city, in danger in the wilderness, danger at sea, danger from false brothers, in toil, in hardship, through many sleepless nights, in hunger, in thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure. 500 miles of that. We're talking about going. You got to think, you got to count the cost. You got to count the cost. And it says, apart from all those things, then there's the daily pressure of my anxiety for all the churches. Then there's the work on top of all the, what you have to put up with just to do the work. And I think so, really, the second quality I want to bring out here is you need a ton of courage. You got to care, and you've got to have the guts to back it up, because the world is not going to roll over for us. It's not going to do it. You know, people can be courageous. One of the things I deplore about this sort of suicide bombing, is the way that vulnerable people are worked on, manipulated, and controlled, and told things until eventually they're prepared to do things under duress or whatever, that are absolutely deplorable, and then they're held up as heroes. People who, not like this, who were able to know what they were doing, know why they were doing it in full conscience with their eyes wide open. Courage is taking on trouble when you know there's trouble, isn't it? It's not foolhardiness. These men are not foolhardy. This is real courage, true courage, when you know what's up ahead. And I want to take on then this third quality, apart from this courage, this care and this courage that we should have exhibited. These things are to stir us up, aren't they? To make us think, to provoke us, to get us thinking. This third one then, because actually the work they were involved with, and I don't think it's a coincidence, this desire to go, what were they going to do? They were there to keep the lines of communication open. That's what their work was all about. The communications. And we all know today, don't we, about the vital strategic value of communications. Robert Preston, did anybody hear Robert Preston talking on the radio about communications in business the other day? The stock markets, absolutely fascinating this. And the stock markets, because obviously if there's a deal to be done, if you're the first person in the queue, you get to do the deal. You're the first person who finds out what's going on. You're the one who gets the price, and so on and so forth. So now, like for example, New York and Chicago stock exchanges, they do all their deals by fiber optic cables. So they can communicate at the speed of light. Because that is how important it is to be there first. That's how important it is to communicate your offer. That's how important it is to hear the bids that are out there. That's how important it is to get the information that you need to make the right decision, because the consequences of that is literally is fortunes. There are fortunes. So much so, this is quite amazing, that all the fiber optic cables between Chicago and New York, I'm sorry to digress on this, were run along the railway tracks. Because it was a very easy job. You went along to the railway company, you negotiated with them, one negotiation, you decided the price, you dug up the channel going down the already existing cut path of the railway tracks, you laid in your fiber optic cables, and then bang, you've got fiber optic communication A to B, you pay a fee, that's built into the cost price of the sales, and you're away. Somebody came in with a bid to build a fiber optic communication link between Chicago and New York that went across mountains, under lakes, I mean, it was the most torturous route in which they had to negotiate every single land deal with every single land owner between Chicago and New York. The costs and the headache that were involved are just astronomical, but it was worth their while to do it. And do you know what they got? Because, of course, if you cut a straighter line from New York to Chicago, you can get an edge on speed. Light will travel that bit faster. I think they got 0.0015 of a millisecond faster than the other fiber optic thing. And it was worth it. It was worth them to do it. Because communication is matters. And as Christians, communication is the hub and basis of what we're all about. That's what we do. That's what we're called to do. To go with the gospel to communicate, isn't it? And these people were passionate about communicating. They were dedicated to communication, to keeping the lines of the communication open. It would be so nice. You've got a little church in Philippi over there, and they've got their little hub over there. You've got a church over there. They weren't happy with that. They wanted to make sure that this church there, that church there, that these people were communicating with one body, one faith, one church, one God, one faith, one baptism, one hope. And to keep those lines of communication open so that everybody could be moving together, growing together. And they dedicated themselves to that. Paul was working with Timothy, who was going for him. Epaphroditus was going on behalf of the Philippian church. He's taking these torturous journeys because communication matters that much. And of the heroes that he singles out, communicators were the people that he's focusing his attention on. You look at verse 24, this man is in prison. Paul is in prison, and he doesn't plan. When I come out, the first thing I'm going to do is go and have egg and chips in the local whatever and where and book off 2 weeks in Ibiza. He's ready to go. Get me out of here, and I'm going again. Because of the passion. There's no surprises that Timothy and Epaphroditus, the way they were, with a man like that as your mentor, with that care, with that courage, with those communication passions and skills, it's not surprising that these men ended up in his mold. And that's so important, isn't it? I know everybody here cares. And we all have a measure of courage and we're willing. But this passion to communicate, this ability, this is wonderful, isn't it? When you find somebody who can communicate, really communicate as they did. And we have to move away from the idea that communication is just a verbal thing. You know, how many of you have ever been to a lecture and the lecturer's got a piece of paper and they've got some things written on their things and all they do is literally speak it off and then they hand it over and then you've made your notes of exactly the same thing and you go away with the piece of paper that they had and they could have faxed it to you or emailed it and you could have stayed at home. Communication is more. It's a relationship. It's a built-in trust that develops over time where you come to trust the person who's speaking and the integrity of what's being said. And your understanding of it increases and grows and your knowledge expands until eventually it isn't their message anymore. You've got it. You've got it. You're running with it. This is your gospel. He's your God. You're his people, not the God of the pastor, your God. And that's what they were committed to. It's hard work, building trust, knocking down all those resistances, identifying the misunderstandings, laboring. But they did it. So here we are. There's these qualities for the gospel hero. Concern, the courage, and that communication. Those three things, all right? Okay. So let's respond to it briefly then. I've got to recognize, haven't we? We have to recognize these qualities that are there. How common are they? How common are they? How many people do you know can say, that person is just like that? Because what we have to recognize from this passage that people like that are actually far and few between, the truth be told. And we have a culture at the moment of the celebration of mediocrity. I think you probably all agree. We all get a prize. We're all winners. We all get a round of applause and everything's awesome. But that's not what this passage says. That's not what this passage says. And the book of Proverbs, chapter 20, verse 6 says, many claim to have unfailing love, but a faithful man, who can find? I love that. It's got a little Jewish twist on it. Who can find? I can't find one. They're hard to find. People like that. Actually, do you watch The Apprentice? Anybody watch The Apprentice? Okay, you're forgiven. So do I. Right? When you watch The Apprentice, these people make most outrageous brags and boasts about themselves. It is shocking, the things. And you're thinking to yourself, this better be true. This better be true. Because you, do you not realize how many people are watching you on television? The cloud of witnesses that witnesses. You better, when you say you're a lion in business, you better roar. In the last episode, it turned out, most of the guys, the women actually, were pretty good. They had a good measure of integrity, I have to say. But the blokes were either stupid or liars. There was no two other ways about it. I could not believe the vacuousness. Straw men. Straw men. It was appalling. It was appalling. You know, it's very hard to find a truly good person. Person of real substance and real character and genuine courage and passionate communication, something to give, something to say. It's hard to find. And in verse 20 and 21, going back to our passage there, we've just said that Timothy, as far as Paul is concerned, there's nobody like him. And wouldn't it be lovely to say, as you look into verse 21, that the reason there's nobody like him is because he's that bit better than the rest of you. But that's not what he says. Look at it in verse 21. He says, everyone else looks out for his own interest and not for the interest of Jesus Christ. The truth was, as he looked around the Christian scene, it was appalling. It was shocking. It was shameful. The selfishness, the self-interest was deplorable. And actually, what we're noticing about Timothy, the reason he's up receiving his Oscar, is not because he's so much better than all these other wonderful people, because he just seems to be one of the only normal people around. That the measure of abnormality as the pressure is going on, the fall away rate, the slackness rate is such that the reason he stands out is because everybody, right behind you, Paul, 500 yards behind you. The reason he ends up volunteer, would somebody please volunteer? And everybody stands back. The reason these people stand out is not because they're so exceptional, because other people, it seems from this, are so lacking in the basic qualities of care, courage, and communication that seem just foundational to ordinary Christian life. That's how I see it. That's how I see it. I love that saying, you know, how many people have you seen being interviewed? People have done heroic things. You see them being interviewed. What do they often say? It's what any normal person would have done if they were in my situation. Isn't that what they say? And this is, they did what any normal person would do in their situation. And the reason it doesn't get done is because of the abnormalities, the effects of this world and all the rest of it that just draw upon us. I was just thinking about that. That's Jesus' invitation to the banquet, and everybody's been invited to the banquet, and I've just gone married, I've just bought a plow, I've just bought a field, and the list of excuses. When the going gets tough, the tough get going, don't they? And that means that people who are truly tough really do hunker down and do the job, right? But it also means the people who've been bragging how tough they are, they disappear. And that's what you see. And that's what you see. Where are the courageous pastors? Where are the intrepid evangelists, the intrepid missionaries? the determined evangelists, the ceaseless prayers, the passionate worshippers. The truth is, there are not many. They're not many. And when they come along, somebody once said, a fanatic is somebody who loves Jesus more than you do. The danger is when they come along because they make you feel that you are not a great Christian and you're not praying as you should and you're not living like you could. Oftentimes we hate them. We step back from them. We look down at our shoes. We disappear. Rather than realizing the opportunity that these people give us to inspire us to go higher, to do more. Because, you know, the truth is, we're not all going to be Christian heroes. Let's be clear about that. We're not all going to be Christian heroes. We're not all going to shine as brightly. Even the stars in the heaven, they don't all shine the same brightness. But if they make a little bit of a difference in our lives, if we become a bit bolder, a bit more courageous, a bit more intrepid, a bit more prayerful, a bit more worshipful, a bit more holy, if you take a stack of 1p pieces, you will get a pound. And if we're all just changed a bit, then that's got to be good. Who are your heroes? Who are your Christian heroes? Who are your gospel heroes? Who are the people that inspire you, challenge you to go higher, go further, do more, live for God? Think about it. Bible people, people in the scriptures, absolutely. How about people in history, people who've lived for God in history? Anybody you know? Anybody's alive today? You got heroes, living heroes today? How about, they may not be known by lots of other people, people you know, and you know that if they weren't there, your life would be not as guided and directed and energetic as it presently is. It's worth honoring people like that, isn't it? It's worth honoring people like that. Because as we see in verse 27, as I just move to the close, you see in verse 27 that Paul was at a moment where Epaphroditus was nearly taken from him. He nearly died. And Paul had a ton of trouble in his life. And he says that if he had died, it would have been heaping sorrow upon sorrows. He's almost saying, I'm not sure if I could have, it might have overwhelmed me to lose people who inspire me, to give me people who give me hope, people who give me courage. If the sky was without stars, I'd be like a mariner at sea with no direction, without compass. I might lose my compass. Godly people in our lives are an absolute blessing, aren't they? They really are. And I think that's the substance of what he's saying. Well, what can we do about it? At the end, last little bit here, in verse 29, honor men like this. And he tells the church to receive them, receive Epaphroditus with joy, doesn't he? We may not all be able to be Christian heroes, though I hope what I've said today should at least make you say, well, if not them, then who? If it's not me, then who? Who's going to do it? Who's going to go? Maybe I have to aim a little higher. But the very least we can do is honor, welcome, and receive such people and give them every support that we can so they can do the work and keep going, keep shining for Jesus, and welcome them with joy. Well, my lecturer's piece of paper is over. I hope I haven't just simply delivered what's on the piece of paper to you. We need to pray, don't we? Let's ask God. Let's just have a couple of moments of quiet before we sing our closing hymn.